This morning is Abdelatter against Gonzalez. Mr. Burton.
May it please the court, my name is Justin Burton. I'm here on behalf of Laith Abdelkader in his petition for review of the Board of Immigration Appeals decision. The first question we must ask ourselves is whether this court has jurisdiction over these matters. When initially filing the petition for review and the briefs in this case, this court had yet to determine whether it had jurisdiction on crimes involving moral turpitude. In the last 4 months, two cases have come out, both Padilla and Mai, which basically said that you have jurisdiction to review whether they are crimes involving moral turpitude.
How long was the tourist visa for?
It was for 6 months, Your Honor, and I'm not sure if he extended out his tourist visa or not.
One other question, I'll let you go, I'm sorry. But was he here lawfully at the time he applied for adjustment of status? And if not, is that even relevant in determining which admission date to consider?
There may have been, and I'm not sure, a gap of a few months in whether he fell out of status or simply overstayed here in the United States. But it's not relevant for purposes of immigration law whether he fell out of status and is applying through an immediate relative.
What do you mean, fell out of status? Is that some kind of jargon? You mean his visa expired?
His visa expired.
So that he was not here lawfully.
Right. It's either considered an overstay or fell out of status.
I have no idea what fall out of status means. I understand what fall out of an airplane means.
Sure. Generally, it's referenced. It's a term of art used.
Yeah, could you translate it into English?
Sure, Your Honor. It's simply overstaying your status in the United States, allowing or your state to expire.
I understand what overstay a visa is. I do not understand what overstay a status is. I think you should perhaps proceed.
Sure, Your Honor.
Avoid jargon.
Sure, Your Honor. In this case, when discussing jurisdiction, it's actually changed quite drastically within the last 2 weeks to incorporate other arguments that we had made in our briefs. The Real ID Act, which was passed 2.5 weeks ago, expanded jurisdiction before this court to determine both constitutional and legal claims before it.
I would like us to focus for a moment on, though, it seems to me the key issue is this crime of moral turpitude issue, because I have to tell you that regardless of the 5-year point, the government has argued in the alternative that he committed two acts of moral turpitude by these two separate purchases. And I have to say, that position of the government's is quite consistent with quite a bit of law from this court in many other areas, whether you've committed two different drug transactions. We sometimes say that even if it's an hour and a half apart. And this was two separate days, two separate transactions. So it seems to me, at bottom, this is going to get down to whether WIC fraud is a crime of moral turpitude. If it isn't, then
that's correct.
A lot of things flow that are positive for your client. If it is, though, I just don't see how you can get around the two-act requirement.
Under the Immigration Act, it determines even if there are two crimes involving moral turpitude committed, the central question would be, did it involve a single scheme of criminal misconduct?
Right, and that's why I'm saying the law, at least in lots of other areas, is very unfavorable to you, unless we have some special rule for single actor scheme for immigration, and I don't know why we would.
Why isn't
this a crime of moral turpitude? Under federal law, it's actually a felony to misuse food stamp coupons if the transaction is $5,000 or more, and both of his were.
Under Illinois state law and the elements of the offense that he was convicted, it doesn't necessarily point out that fraud is a element to the offense.
Well,
it actually,
you know, you argue that, but I looked at this Illinois law, putting to one side the issues of federal law, which really doesn't approve of misusing federally supported, you know, funds for federally supported programs. But I'm having trouble figuring out, once the Illinois law requires a knowing misuse of these funds, how that isn't properly defined as fraud on a pure elements approach. Forget about the fact that he was engaged in some fairly big transactions.
Sure. Under the elements approach, even though part of it may be interpreted to indicate that he may have misrepresented himself or may have fraudulently represented himself, there are elements that just merely possession alone in this context.
Well, you have to knowingly, number one, use, acquire, possess, or transfer, number two, these food instruments in any manner not authorized by law or rules of the Illinois Department. So you've got to knowingly do something with them. Use, acquire, possess in a way not authorized.
But using the
What's the innocent, non-fraudulent example you'd like to give?
An example would be a sibling would go get food or medicines for their sister or brother who happens to be on the WIC. They walk down the street, they're given the food stamps to go purchase it, they walk in the store, purchase it, walk back down the street to give it to the sibling, and they drink the milk, or they eat the cookies, or they take some of the medicines. I certainly don't think that would imply moral turpitude if you're walking the groceries or walking the medication back to the person
who... Why isn't that fraud? If you buy a gun as a stalking horse for somebody else so that the other person doesn't give his own ID, and then give the gun to him, would it be less a crime, less an example of fraud, if the other person could have bought the gun legally, but it was just done in order to prevent the seller from learning his identity?
But I think we also have to go towards intent, and innocuously somebody could have unlawfully used it.
Well, his intent may be interesting, but that was established in the state case, because this is a specific intent crime.
Right, right. But it's also a category approach in trying to prove up the government's burden in establishing that it was a crime involving moral turpitude. In saying that, I mean, it could be innocuously used, and you could be, even though possessing it, you could be convicted of these offenses, and it may not implicate a crime involving moral turpitude. And it's difficult, I think, it's based on Padilla and based on May, to go beyond the categorical approach to determine whether the actions that precipitated the indictment and the eventual conviction was involving crimes involving moral turpitude. I think we have to keep in mind the categorical approach in determining...
Yeah, but I understand that. But categorically, one thinks of crimes of moral turpitude as those involving misstatement or deceit, right? And your client misstated how he came by these certificates. I mean, all the hard cases in crimes of moral turpitude are those like our decision in Wei Kong Mei, where we had to ask the question whether driving 105 miles an hour is a crime of moral turpitude because it recklessly endangers bystanders. Are there any crimes involving intentional deceit or misstatement that are not treated as crimes of moral turpitude?
Not that I know of, because at least in recent case law, it's very difficult to get before your honors jurisdictionally in arguing crimes involving moral turpitude. And oftentimes, due to the amendments of IRA-IRA, a lot of these crimes are classified as aggravated felonies under the Immigration Act, so they eventually didn't make it up to this level. I think also...
I don't understand that.
Well, the
immigration... We always have jurisdiction to determine our jurisdiction. We held that back in Yang in 1997. So whether a particular removable offense is a crime of moral turpitude is something we have always had jurisdiction to consider.
Well, oftentimes, instead of going the government proceeding on removability on the grounds of crimes involving moral turpitude, they simply leap towards the aggravated felony grounds. So a lot of these cases didn't make it before Your Honor. There's not much case law discussing whether fraud crimes per se are crimes involving moral turpitude. In this case,
it doesn't even matter whether it's fraud. That's the reason why I phrased the question the way I did, which is, I mean, I've understood moral turpitude as crimes involving deceitful statements. And fraud may be an elevated level of deceitful statements. Are there examples where courts have said that a particular crime involving deceit or misstatement is not of moral turpitude, say, because it's not common law fraud? I mean, that would be a holding very useful to you. I just wonder if there are any.
Not that I know of, Your Honor. I think the closest the courts have come was in recent case law within the last 5 or 6 months in defining what a crime involving moral turpitude has been. I think it's changed progressively over the last 40 years, both in criminal aspects and the immigration aspect, on what is depraved and vile, to now the standard used before Your Honors that was distinguished in May and Padilla. I think, again, the categorical approach, I think looking at the intent, I mean, we must look at the elements of the offense to determine whether, in fact, it is a crime involving moral turpitude, and in that the underlying activity may have fraudulent intent. The categorical approach and looking at the elements certainly do not require it. Thank you, Your Honors.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Burton.
Thank you.
Mr. Potter.
Good morning. May it please the Court. Jonathan Potter on behalf of the Attorney General.
Mr. Potter, I've of course been listening to this interchange, and it just kind of occurs to me. Would that mean if a parent purchased Lucky Charms cereal for their child, they would violate the statute because it's not an approved food? Because the statute appears to criminalize any use of WIC coupons that are contrary to WIC rules, you know, and there are these approved foods.
Your Honor, there's two answers to that question. The first answer is, number one, and I apologize, this was not raised in our brief, this was never addressed before the board. The petitioner never argued that this was not a crime of moral turpitude before the board, or even before the IJ. So he has failed to exhaust. So that answers that question, number one. Number two,
But did you waive the exhaustion?
No, you never waive jurisdictional issues, Your Honor.
Well, that's not a jurisdictional issue.
There was a petition for review filed within 30 days. What more is necessary for jurisdiction?
Well, Your Honor, in this case, you must exhaust before the board.
Yes,
it doesn't mean you don't have to exhaust.
A jurisdictional problem.
Well, Your Honor, just pointing out that the petitioner is not before.
No, what makes exhaustion a jurisdictional problem? You could have one of two possible answers. You could have a statute saying that, or you could have a decision of Supreme Court.
Excuse me, Your Honor. It's the statute says that. The Immigration Nationality Act says that. That
says
you have to exhaust.
The federal courts of appeals shall have no jurisdiction, or does it say
the petitioner must exhaust
before
the board?
Right, and the same is true with prisoners who file prison litigation things. Exhaustion is an important requirement, as a matter of fact, but it doesn't mean that it's jurisdictional necessarily. Not all important things are jurisdictional, and not all jurisdictional things, well, maybe all jurisdictional things are important, but not all important things are jurisdictional.
Understood, Your Honor.
I, though, wanted to get back to what, since I don't think you really have an answer to that, I wanted to get back to what Judge Rovner was talking about, because the law and rules of the Illinois Department of Public Health or Department of Human Services with respect to the WIC program are notoriously complex. And if someone in good faith goes to the grocery store and picks up the Lucky Charms, or if they, you know, present, their state ID card as identification, and instead the rules say, no, you have to present your state ID card plus your Social Security card or something. They're all manner of picayune things that you wouldn't be said not knowingly to do, but that don't sound at all fraudulent. They sound like you knowingly failed to comply with this rule in a manner that the rule was just not that important.
Well, Your Honor, if you look at the actual indictment in this case, it wasn't.
But that's where you're getting away from the elements approach. This court and the Supreme Court have said, rather than have us retry the underlying facts of every case, what we need to do is to be able to look at what has to be proven all the time, whether it's you know, driving recklessly, or whether it's food stamp misuse, or whatever it may be.
Your Honor, the indictment in this case was, first of all, labeled fraud.
So we're suppose it calls fraud crossing the street against a red light.
And furthermore, in that indictment, it made
clear
that...
Were you here,
it,
by the way, for the second case?
Yes, I was,
Your
Honor.
Your predecessor for the United States say it doesn't matter what something is called? It can really be an extortion offense, even if it's called wrongful inducement? I mean, why should another lawyer for the United States now tell us it matters what it's called?
Well, Your Honor, that's not my entire argument either. I'm saying that within that fraud indictment is a claim that there's a misrepresentation on the part of the petitioner in this case. And that's clearly fraud. In that he misrepresented.
Not all misrepresentation is fraud.
But in this case,
one reason why I asked the question of your adversary about whether moral turpitude, whether all crimes involving misrepresentation are moral turpitude, even if they aren't fraud.
Your Honor, I would say that in this case, it's clear that he gained from his fraudulent conduct. Money from the food stamp fraud in this case.
And I don't think anyone disagrees with you that if we can get all the way down to the particular details of what Mr. Abdel Kader did, it looks a lot like fraud. But it's this statute that we're looking at. Is it possible knowingly to possess food instruments, as they're called in the statute, in any manner not authorized by law or rules, and nonetheless not be engaging in fraud?
The important,
give them to your grandmother for safekeeping, and she's not, you know, a woman with an infant or child, and she keeps them for a while. Well, you knowingly gave them to her. She possesses them. She's not an authorized possessor, but she's just keeping them in her drawer while you're on vacation, so no one steals them. Is that fraud?
In this case, Your Honor, there's an important word that's missing from your analogy, and that's misrepresent. In this case, he misrepresented.
It doesn't say that in the statute. I'm looking at the language of the statute. A person who knowingly uses, acquires, possesses, or transfers these instruments in any manner not authorized by law or the rules of the Illinois Department of Public Health or Department of Human Services, ... is guilty of a violation and shall be punished. So where is the word misrepresent?
There's also the word knowingly in this case.
I know, and I gave you an example where I think somebody knowingly possesses food instruments in a manner not authorized by the law. It's the grandmother who's holding them for her daughter while the daughter's on vacation to avoid theft.
Your Honor, I would submit
you're
that is not...
You're going to prosecute her?
I would submit that is not probably contrary to law for somebody to hold those documents.
It says knowingly possesses in any manner not authorized by law.
But in that case, that would not be a case where
I assume prosecutorial discretion would play some role. Our issue here is what does the statute actually prohibit?
I understand that, Your Honor. And in this case, it's clear what this individual did. And it's clear from the statute that he violated...
So you're basically arguing don't take an elements approach, go to the particulars of the offense.
No, Your Honor, I'm not arguing that. I'm saying look at the total factual situation here.
Look, a response to a question about what are the elements of the offense cannot be answered by saying, look at the facts here. The facts here are irrelevant to what the elements of the offense are. In order to figure out what violates this statute, I assume one has to go to the regulations to which it refers.
That's correct, Your
right?
Honor.
If you do that, do you find that the grandmother case violates the law or not? I mean, what's underlying this?
Well, in this case, Your Honor, the petitioner pled guilty to the offense, and there's nothing in...
The plea of guilty has nothing to do with the contents of the regulations.
I understand that, Your Honor, but he never argued before the board or the immigration judge, which were the particulars, saying,
but
I am not guilty of this offense.
I don't recall that your brief made an argument that he had failed to exhaust.
That's correct, Your Honor, and I apologize for that.
So it's,
our brief did not
you
do
don't
that.
Have to apologize to us for that. I think you That's probably right. have to apologize to the Attorney General.
That's correct, Your Honor. As not being the author of this brief, I humbly apologize for our omission. If there's nothing further, we ask this court to...
No, I have another question.
Okay. Yes, ma'am.
I'm sorry, but because in the brief, whoever it was, seemed to concede that Abdelkader's initial entry was an admission, as was the adjustment of status. So here's what I was wondering. If there are, in fact, two admissions here, why shouldn't the initial one control for purposes of the five-year rule, given that he continually resided in the United States from the time of that initial admission?
Hopefully I can explain our position to this cogently. First of all, there was a discussion about falling out of status, overstay of status. I want to give what I think that lingo means, at least as far as the Office of Immigration Litigation. That means you come from a legal alien to illegal alien. As far as your question, ma'am.
I don't know what that means either. I think you mean, can anybody actually say things in a straight way?
Your Honor,
you mean his visa had expired.
His visa had expired.
Okay.
And
that's
and he's no longer legal. I'm trying to explain what somebody else said, Your Honor. My time's up. Would you like me to complete the...
If you can bear
to... That's okay? Okay. In this case, there were two admissions. The first admission was he came over on a student visa. The INS at the time still existed, and they said, you are okay to stay here under a student visa or a visitor visa. I think it may have been a visitor visa. The second time, he moved to adjust his status. At that time, the INS again made the decision that, yes, we will allow you to adjust your status. We are admitting you for that purpose. The first time they admitted him was for the purpose of his visa. The second time was adjustment of status. It's two separate decisions, two separate admissions, and our position is that the second admission controls.
Even though he continually resided?
Even though he continued to reside, because, once again, Your Honor, the INS had to make a separate, distinct decision to admit this individual on an adjustment of status.
So it's almost as if he had gone back and came back.
Exactly. In fact,
although he didn't.
The dialogue in the record is rather unclear whether...
What in the statute, admit is a defined term in the statute. What in the statute says either admitted or what we think of as a legal equivalent of admitted?
Well, nothing in the statute says that, Your Honor, but you have to give Chevron deference to the board's interpretation.
Only if the statute is ambiguous.
If there's an ambiguity, we don't allow agencies to contradict their government.
That's correct, Your Honor, but it's clear in this case that there's...
What's the ambiguity in the statute that you think needs to be cleared up?
I don't think there is any ambiguity. I think there's an admission for each purpose. And that's what the board determined.
The statute says, and I'm paraphrasing now because I've closed the statute on my screen, shows up at the border physically, right? There's no ambiguity that language does not mean or has his legal status changed while he's here, right? Those are... Nobody would mistake one for the other.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So what's the ambiguity?
I'm not saying there is ambiguity. I'm saying that you get admitted for different purposes, Your Honor. You go before the INS.
Has the board, to your knowledge, ever addressed the question whether this five-year period runs from the first admission or the most recent one?
No, they have not, Your Honor,
because that
I'm aware of.
You see, if it's the most recent one, then you have somebody who, say, is admitted for permanent residence in 1960. Has lived in the United States lawfully for 45 years, goes and visits his mother in his native land every summer. On the view that you're now attributing to it, it's never been more than 1 year since his last admission, and therefore any crime of moral turpitude is gone, even though he's been a 45-year resident. The statute, one would think as a matter of making sense of it makes more sense if the time runs from the first admission rather than the last. And you say the board has never addressed why it has selected the last rather than the first admission?
Not that I'm aware of, Your Honor. It can work to the benefit of the alien or it can work to the detriment of the alien. In this case, the second admission was the admission that the board found to be appropriate. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement. We'll be in recess until tomorrow.